Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is Friday, November 8th, and you
How
are listening
to... How could you like chunky over smooth? Like
Waypoint Radio, episode 201. Smooth. Class is now in session.
I made a peanut butter and jelly sandwich today, and you know what I used?
Smooth.
Chunky. Because I know what the fuck is going on.
Smooth.
Austin
no,
Walker
because I went to the
today.
Store this weekend and bought Chunky on purpose.
This
I
isn't
pushed...
a mistake. Kato didn't fuck up. They're just talking over me. This is real. Those are the voices of Natalie Watson, Patrick Klepek, Rob Zachney also here with us. What is happening? What is the debate?
Patrick is blasphemous.
I get so upset when my wife buys. She sometimes will get that Chunky stuff and then...
Oh, good. Another domestic resentment of Patrick Klepek. Let's dig into this.
Wait, no, peanut butter. We're talking about peanut butter. Chunky or smooth?
We can have both. She prefers the chunky. I just say, just get both. Just get both. Because then I get the chunky and I love peanut butter. And I'll eat
I love
it.
Peanut butter.
But I resent every single bite of it.
Well, can we get a census going here? Patrick, smooth. Rob, smooth. Natalie?
Natalie, my nose just started bleeding.
I'm...
Wait, read that Natalie's... right into the record, Patrick.
Wait, whose nose started bleeding?
Natalie.
Because she was thinking about that chunky peanut butter.
She was
She
was just cutting rails of chunky peanut butter.
Oh my God.
Turns out you shouldn't do that.
Don't do that. Rob, while Natalie's cleaning up, I don't know. Natalie's back.
I don't get strong opinions on this. Like
you don't.
I don't. Like chunky peanut
weak
butter.
Opinions?
It's fine some of the time, right? Like sometimes chunky peanut butter is
yes.
delicious. There
some
are also
the
times
time.
When I just want smooth peanut butter or also there's a lot of times you need to bake, and you can only use smooth peanut butter
because
you're using it as a fat and a flavoring agent.
And a flavoring
agent,
like,
yeah,
totally.
Like, so what's the most useful thing to have?
To as an ingredient, smooth is more accessible and useful.
What if you could only have one in the world? Like, what if you could either
chunky.
Only have chunky or smooth, and the other
chunky.
One is eliminated? You could never have it.
Chunky.
What? No.
This is a thought experiment. You say chunky. You would
chunky.
Lose all food that cooks with peanut butter.
No, I would just cook it with the chunky.
You'd just be like pulling the nuts out.
No, you couldn't. That's what I'm saying. It's magic. You
wait,
could
you
not
can't
remove
make it smooth yourself.
You cannot smooth
no,
the
but
peanut
I, no,
butter.
No, I want to live in the world where Natalie is buying big Costco tubs of chunky peanut butter. She's laying out on the ground, putting it like a tarp.
Yeah.
She dumps it out.
Yeah.
She's got a bucket where she's just extracting like gold.
The nuts.
Like
yeah,
just
like
shoving
gold.
The smooth
yeah.
peanut butter through to get those nuts out.
God. I would go smooth. I like smooth better as it is. Like my default, I'd rather have smooth peanut butter 99% of the time. Every now and then, I don't
when
mind
do you
it.
Go for a chunk? Oh, you don't mind a chunky?
I don't mind it if it's a if it's once in a while. But if I go to the store and come home with chunky peanut butter, it's going to go in my cupboard for months. And I'm going to go out and buy another different smooth one.
Damn.
That's who I am.
If it's good enough, Santana, it's good enough for me.
Excuse me? Santana?
Who?
Smooth by Rob Thomas. I hate this. I hate the show we're doing.
I thought you were doing a bit.
No. No.
You're the only one.
You're the only one who thought of Smooth by Carlos Santana featuring Rob Thomas.
No, I'm pretty sure that's an extremely popular song.
It is extremely
I'm not being sarcastic on that. I think it's like more popular than you would think.
It's
like
more popular than anything
ranking.
We've ever done.
How popular?
For sure.
How popular is Rob Thomas?
It has Santana. A great opening line. I think, man, it's a hot one is a great opening line.
Yes. Here we go. August 2nd, 2018.
Smooth
loading
Santana.
Loading up this article from Billboard.
Do
happy
the right
60th
thing.
Birthday, Hot 100. Santana and Rob Thomas's Smooth is still your second biggest song ever. The people are with me.
I did a search for Smooth Santana Spike Lee Do the Right Thing AMV, and nothing, it didn't come up. I'm a little upset about that. I thought
it's
like just,
it's an opportunity.
Yeah, I have to make one. I make another AMV this week. Today, as you might have already guessed, we are focusing on some questions. We have a question bucket that is filled with questions, new and old, and we got some time in front of us. So let's just start digging in. And I've kind of pulled out some new ones to try to stay fresh. But if we want to dip into the old ones, you just let me know. We got what, like 26 in there from 2 years ago, so there's a chance, you know. Slowly working our way through it all. This first one comes in from Carlos. It was a K-A, but then the A had like
Carlos actually wrote in?
Carlos Santana has written in and says, wow, I love your subterfuge coverage so much. I would love to know. So Carlos wrote in and said that the subterfuge game was really interesting because it presented this notion of the security dilemma, which is a thing in international relations I don't want to get into, and this is a whole long thing. But my question to you all is, do you have any other examples besides subterfuge of a systemic approach to political thought being portrayed in games? I'd love to hear Rob's thoughts regarding war games, but with your recent discussions of AAA developers' reluctance to embrace the portrayal of the political climate in their games, perhaps you have some ideas of games, or any other media for that matter, that tackle a particular worldview with the same clarity. Thank you all for your great work. All the best from Latvia and London, Carlos.
I mean, so if you want to talk about, like, international relations modeling, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think Europa Universalis IV is legitimately a good attempt at doing that. And basically what it's modeling is this idea that relationships take a long time to form in IR. Like, even if, like, two countries' interests align, if they have historically not gotten along or just haven't interacted, there is no real fondness or affection between those nations. And so what you have to do is actually invest your diplomatic resources in generating that kind of goodwill and making those outreach efforts through, like, you know, if you're like monarchies, arranged marriages, treaties,
right.
You know, gifts. Later on, it can be other things as well, but friction points will be a downward drag on that. So I think EU4 does a good job of modeling IR. It also tries to touch on things like political thought to an extent, in the sense that, you know, when the Reformation hits, it radically recasts the political landscape in Europa Universalis IV, because suddenly, like, large fractions of Europe go over to various flavors of Protestantism, and then a lot of Europe stays under Catholicism, and that creates, like, instant schisms that cut across pre-existing diplomatic alignments, which is really cool. Last thing I'll point you to, if you really want to see a game with an interesting take at like modeling political thought, Victoria 2 is a game that actually has like really detailed demographics of your country. And so, like, for instance, one of the interesting things that it tries to get into, and it's a very, it's funny. I think a lot of people who worked on it were fairly conservative in terms of their political beliefs, but the game ends up being kind of Marxist because it just roughly ends up replicating like a lot of Marxist thought and theory and like theories of history. So like one of the things it depicts is a lot of primarily agricultural countries with like large peasant classes and like small craftsmen in the countryside being overtaken by industrialization and creating new classes of workers for like factories and like industrial revolution type jobs. The catch is those jobs require things like an educated workforce. So you build schools. But once the classes develop class awareness and their education level sort of catches up, suddenly they don't just want to be like peasants, but they work in factories. They want like other things too. And then all hell breaks loose. So that's actually a pretty cool game that tries to get at some of that stuff.
I would say this is a great instance of, there's that great phrase, hidden curriculums, right? Like the things in our world, the media that we have, but also literally our educational systems. And in this case, our games are often filled with a sort of hidden curricula of information, ideas, and worldviews that are taught to us, even though they are not necessarily being pedagogical in the moment. You look at something like the SimCity series, right? And look at the ways in which like those games model. I want to be clear, not just the SimCity series. I think this is true for most city simulations in different ways, but they all have a certain idea of the way taxes work. They all have a certain idea of the way population density creates or, you know, affects the availability of luxury goods or of jobs, about the ways in which waste is produced and managed, especially the way things like crime are produced and affect the residents of a city. Games are filled with that stuff, especially strategy games, and especially games that care about society in that way. And so I think, for me, the thing that I think about the other way is, so that's one way, which is like, okay, how does City Skylines, how does SimCity do that stuff constantly, whether or not they believe it? In some cases, like, I can't pull the particular person out of name out of my head right now. I can't pull it out of nowhere. But the initial SimCity was being built on a specific kind of social theory. God, I want to look it up so bad. I'm not going to. I'll do it when I drop and toss to somebody else. I'm going to find the particular person's understanding of economics that it's working off of. But the other side of this is the thing that we've talked about a few times, which is games can sometimes do the other thing and say, like, I'm going to tackle this thing. And in some cases, I think they work pretty well. There's a game I really love called Real Lives 2010. Which is a life simulation that is, I want to say it's built in like Java or something. It is like the most janky, like app you can download from the internet from a weird website that in that same, like in that way that you used to do when you had your first computer. You know what I mean? Just like mm-hmm. weird windows and text boxes and dialogue boxes and stuff, in which it just tosses you in the role of a person in the world. And so one day you might show up and you've been born to two people in Mexico City, and one of them works at a restaurant and one of them sells jewelry in the marketplace. And then, like, all right, you live your life one year at a time and you just like click buttons to see what happens. And it's one of those games that predates what we would call the empathy game, like boom of the or like the games for change boom of the early 2010s. But I think it's actually more effective than a lot of those in just like casting someone's life into relief and be like, all right, here is a person's life from 1 until 50 or until 80 or whatever. And the ease with which those who were born in Western Europe or in North America in industrialized, so-called industrialized countries, the ease with which they can move through society and life. They can cross borders, that you can like rearrange your entire life in that game, it's like one small lesson it teaches, but it teaches that super well, that like it communicates that sort of material privilege with a lot of clarity, especially at that global scale. I don't think it's a perfect game. It came out in 2010. It's an educational piece of software, but it's worth looking at. The other side of that is when they fuck up, and that's like Spent is the one that I come back to a lot. Spent is a game that was designed by an ad agency for like the urban ministry of some place. It's intended to create empathy. It's supposed to be an empathy game. It's supposed to be about creating empathy for those who are the working poor, is I think actually how they talk about it. But studies show, there's a study by Psychology Today that showed that like actually the game has no effect on positive feelings about poor folk. In fact, in some cases, it had negative effects because it taught players. It's a game which you play someone who is working and who is very poor, and who has to try to overcome those things to improve your class standing, get into a better apartment, get into a better house, make sure your kids are eating well. That's all dialogue driven and text based with some like light graphical interface stuff. But for some players, they left it feeling like, oh, well, why don't more poor people just make the right choices? And as someone who grew up on public assistance and who would not be here if my mom did not get her disability check, I absolutely know that, in fact, to be poor is to lose agency, is to not be able to just make choices from a fucking drop-down list. And so that's one of the situations where the game intended to tell me something about the world, and instead, for some subset of its players, taught them the literal opposite thing and modeled the sort of libertarian view on poverty, which is, once the market is totally free, you can just be a free agent, and then everything will just work itself out. The invisible hand will sweep in, and those who work hard will be paid for it. Natalie, is that a hand?
No, I couldn't think of one that I feel like I feel like there are a lot of games that seek to do this sort of thing in the way that you're talking about, Austin. But often, like, show the holes in a way that is counteractive to, like, the mission statement itself that they were going for. But yeah, I didn't have any ones that stood out to me at the top of my head.
How about you, Patrick? Does anything else
nope.
come to mind for you? Okay. I was looking to figure out this SimCity inspiration that I know is somewhere in Ian Bogost's
show notes.
Unit operations, but show notes. It'll make its way into the show notes. All right, next question. Let's keep it moving. Keep it moving quick. This one comes in from Tom, who says, "Longtime listener, first time caller. I'm curious. We live in an era of extremely public online criticism, and I often feel unsure of how or if to partake. I feel comfortable in my convictions and want to express them in a constructive manner, but fear partaking in the discourse in a way that is ultimately harmful or self-serving. There are so many examples of people trying to help and just making it worse, and I wish quite strongly to avoid this. How do you all conduct your more open public criticisms, particularly as people who find yourselves at odds with a vocally conservative body of gamers/professionals? So, what do you think? I feel like this has been, we've been in the middle of this the last couple of weeks in some ways, based on things like the ways outlets have covered the Rockstar labor allegations, but also just in general. You know, we're not that far removed from the time that I wrote a piece about was it fucking David Brooks, the one who said that Italian meats were ruining American education. So, like, yeah, you know, every now and then. That was this year. Do you remember that? Fuck.
No, that feels God. Like last year. It really 100%. Does. If you'd asked me, like,
I swear,
gun to my head, this year or last year, I would have said
last year. It could have been last year. Listen, it could have been. It's been a long time. Is long. It was last year.
Okay. All right. Cool.
Phew. Okay. Survive.
It was last July. It was right after E3. So, you know, I had that take in me about Italian meats. yeah, I think, you know, for my part, the first step I take is, like, do I have anything interesting to actually say here, or am I just trying to get jabs in? And if it is just getting jabs in, are those productive in some way? Are those useful for, like, genuinely, really actually useful, and not just in, like, a quick morale boost way? Because sometimes dunking on something can feel good in a way that you can convince yourself there's a public good being done. but really, for me, it's like, am I identifying something that someone else hasn't already said? Would I be better off boosting someone else who's already said this in a way and co-signing their position? Or do I genuinely have a take that feels unique and feels meaningful and feels like my saying it in my own words gives it my credibility? And there are times for that. And so when I do that, I do my best not to be – I judge really strongly whether or not I want to be mean. Right? I judge very carefully whether or not I want there to be vitriol in my voice. Because sometimes I do. Because there are things that in the world, mostly not inside of the world of gaming, though I think sometimes inside of the world of gaming, there are times that I want that to be the case. You know, when I go back and look at some of the stuff I was writing and talking about when it came to the Black Lives Matter movement in 2014, like, it was important that my anger was there. So much about Black Lives Matter has been about understanding who gets to be angry. And so I don't want to, like, self-censor in that way. I want the right to be angry about being killed by police, right? Like, that is a thing that I think Black folks should continue to be angry about, and ceding the ability to be angry when others are, you know, obviously allowed to be angry is a mistake. So I want to, like, hold that capability in my hands. But when it comes to, like, I think this article is bad, I think this, you know, whatever the article du jour that's going around, I do my best to focus in on ideas. But I don't know that that's that's just my personal strategy, and it served me pretty well. I'm also in a place where, like, as the EIC of something, I cannot swing my elbows the way I used to do as a freelancer. When I was a freelancer, I fucking went in because in some ways, one, you are more in a more precarious position because you don't have health insurance, and because, you know, you are not making a living wage. You're making, you know, a couple of bucks per hour by the time you're done writing a review. But at the same time, because you're not as integral into the sort of political spaces, because you're not going to see somebody at an event necessarily, because you don't have a boss who is going to tell you that, like, you
tone it the fuck down,
for instance, pick your battles, like, it's easier to be the person who can be a bulldog, and I think we need those bulldogs, even if I'm not the bulldog I once was.
Yeah, like, I'm, so when I wrote the piece a couple of weeks back about, like, the media having to do a better job holding sort of, like, folks like Rockstar accountable when you're given access to people in positions of power, and specifically speaking to the labor conditions at Rockstar and the conditions under which Red Dead was made. Like, I made a conscious choice in what I said over social media and in the piece I wrote to not mention the author. And that was, like, for a couple of reasons. One, I know that, because I've seen this happen, I've had to learn this lesson the hard way, is that once you reach a certain sort of popularity, for lack of a better word, like, people will go out and do things that are in your name that you do not intend to happen. And so you have to be so incredibly careful about where that power gets tossed, because you can't control things. To people may be well-intentioned, but they may be doing things, saying things that you don't want them to say. And so in that particular instance, I did and do have, like, very specific sort of criticisms of choices that the reporter or the author made, I tried to focus my criticisms on the idea and sort of, like, the general trend, because although I was using that article to sort of soapbox about this particular point, I was sort of speaking writ large to, like, something that the media should be doing, and failings that I've had, failings that other reporters have had, and that we should hold ourselves to higher standards when given such access in the future. But, like, the reasons for not naming that were twofold. Was one, like I said, mentioning trying to be focused on the idea, and then also realizing, because I've had this go wrong in the past where I have called out people and it went wrong in such a, like, disproportionate way, that when you are going to call someone out specifically, like, and know that certain parts of it are going to get away from you, like, it has to be for, like, very specific reasons in which, like, the good is going to outweigh the bad in terms of, like, what you are attacking. And even, like smaller stuff, like, it used to be a lot more fun to just, like, dunk on people on Twitter, like, just shitty people who are just, like, being purposely shitty. Like, it was fun to, like, quote tweet someone that's being an asshole and just say something snarky back. I just don't really do that stuff anymore. I used to do it, I don't know, say a lot, but, like, frequently enough that I remember doing it. And then I have just kind of gotten away from that because some person who's being shitty, quote tweeting them and then dunking on them. Like, what does that accomplish? Like, I'm not attacking an idea. I'm not even attacking a real person. Like that person.
Well, especially if it's like, okay, this is a person with 500 followers. Half the time, like, all I would be doing if I was doing that would be giving them the platform that we've built, right? Is like, hey, this is a person who's just being, like, a shithead to me. It's so easy for me
to. They're just trying to get this out. I'm just giving, like, what I get out of likes and retweets over people agreeing with a well-written dunk. It doesn't advance if it's not advancing anything. Like, when I've gotten around to doing that stuff these days, it's like, okay, you're going to screen capture it, you're going to blur out the person, and then I'll get, you know, criticized from some folks, like, well, why cover the identity of this person?
Or whatever, yeah.
Right, and, like, I understand where that criticism or that reaction comes from, but for me, it's more like, okay, if I'm going to choose to be, this is the person, this is the account, this is the tweet that I'm going to deconstruct and respond to, hopefully the reason that I'm doing that is because it's not about a knee-jerk response. It's more about there's an idea that needs to be deconstructed here, and I think it is worth weighing in, talking about it, and working through it, because it's less about the person as much as, like, what this thing represents.
Sure, but I also think that I think that's very true, and I think there are instances in which the ideas are more prevalent, but I think it's also important to, like, there's a difference between calling people out and, like, holding people accountable. And I think there's a way to constructively hold people accountable to, or it can be in the way that you're talking about, Patrick, where you, like, blur out the names and just say, you know, don't do this. Like, if you're perpetrating, like, a format that is dangerous. Like, I think, you know, even with the reports of the shooting this morning, like, we see time and time and again outlets using creating like legacy profiles, like using names, like doing profiles on the perpetrators of these horrific crimes and of these mass shootings, and time and time again, like, it just keeps on happening. And like, there are times when, like, it is like what you're doing is dangerous, when things that you're doing is dangerous, or you know, you have to hold people accountable to that sort of thing. But in terms of like participating in discourse, it can be, it is frustrating to receive criticism that doesn't feel well founded, that doesn't feel like you took the time to. Yeah. So I would say, like, if you're going to respond to something, take the time to like really read it through, and like you said, Austin, like, feel, like, scan the responses, you know, scan like what the discourse has looked like. If you are adding to a choir of similar responses, then maybe it's not super necessary. If you feel like you have something nuanced to say, then perhaps that's different. But the most frustrating thing to be is to be genuinely seeking out feedback and criticism, because I think that criticism can be is constructive, and you know, discourse requires like multiple voices from multiple perspectives. But to feel like what you have said hasn't even been read, and what you're getting is knee-jerk reactions and knee-jerk responses is frustrating, and it feels like a failure of the system itself. So
Totally. I think I do want to clarify a couple things there, just because I want to make sure people don't walk away thinking that what I was saying was like, don't bother responding at all to things, right? There's I think a distinction between, I'm not saying bite your tongue when you see injustice, right?
Yeah.
What I am saying is, I'm never giving Colin Moriarty my platform, no matter how many of you motherfuckers ask me to debate him.
Yeah, a troll.
I'm never giving somebody else who I think would benefit from my credibility. I'm never going to co-sign that, which is what tends to happen when I lean in that way, right? Which
is getting, like, dragged down to their level by the sheer act of engagement.
Yeah. You know, partly it is about levels, but I think partly it's also just about, like,
legitimizing
a perspective and like engaging in head on with something like that is like, and also part of it is like, I don't give up. Like, I'm not trying to win a debate. Like, I'm trying to put my ideas into the world, and those ideas are clear, and those ideas are able to be arrived at. But that's a different thing than like trying to call out someone who has been abusive, or trying to make sure people understand here's the other big one is the other thing at this point is, I've been in this industry long enough that when this comes up, I tend to just message someone privately and be like, yo, this is actually fucked up. Right. And that ends up being a much more constructive and powerful way to convince someone that they fucked up than if I put them on blast in public. The times that I'm still really willing to put people blast on public is when I'm punching up, when I'm punching at a, not directly at a peer, but at a company, at someone who's representing or doing the work of a major corporation, and where I think it's important to recognize what the power structure is there, so that it is not just like, yo, you wrote a shitty review. And what it is like, hey, yo, CD Projekt Red, the way that you have been acting on both your account and on the Good Old Games account is indicating that you think that trans lives don't matter, right? Like, you are deeply dehumanizing a group of human beings. I'm willing to say that every day. And like, if you're the person who runs that social account, do fucking better. That's the places where, like, I'm hyper comfortable being aggressive and rude, because CD Projekt Red has such a bigger, like, all of these game companies have such a bigger reach than what we have, so dramatically outnumbered in that way, that I'm not calling attention. I'm not giving them a platform. I'm using my platform to call attention. Rob, as you know, as our number one elbow thrower right now.
Sassmaster.
Oh, I don't know.
Sassmaster, Sassmaster Incorporated. Rob
Zachney. I tend to be pretty circumspect. You know, just generally approving from the sidelines. I don't like to call people out. And no, I mean, I think for me, what's the way to put this? So as a freelancer, a lot of what you're doing is you're watching what you fucking say. Like, there's a lot of stuff that, you just don't, you see it, you don't love it, you don't comment on it, though, because, like, that shit gets remembered. Like, there's a few editors who are comfortable putting out there, like, how fucking petty they were. There are a few editors who would, like, sort of let the mask slip and be like, you know, hey, just pro tip to freelancers out there. But, and, like, you always figure if there's those people who are showing that, there's probably a couple others who, like, even if they don't know it, maybe do carry, like, grudges they're not even aware of, right? And so you always have to be, like, really friendly, positive, infinitely forgiving, including like of people who also just don't fucking pay you for ages on end.
That part sucks. Yeah.
And so part of it is I did my time of like eating shit with a smile. Mm-hmm. And I also did my time of watching people phone it in and doing work that like, I knew I coulda, or a lot of peers coulda done far better work, made much more of an opportunity, and see that we're good people who are willing to play a different ballgame, right? Who are willing to be a little less pointed or critical in their coverage. And I'm at a point where I just don't have to give a shit anymore. Like, I don't have to pretend that that's cool or that we're peers. Fuck you. Like, if you're just going to sit here taking up space, what the fuck good are you? Like,
I have, like, such the opposite thing. I have such the opposite thing, which is, like, as a freelancer, I had the freedom to do that because I was an outsider.
Yeah.
And, like, especially as a black, like, queer freelancer, like, there was not a world in which I was – where I felt represented. And so I was like, yo, fuck off. There are people who still have me blocked and have me muted who are like not because I was like mad at the way that they were handling Gamergate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not even mad, not even like fuck off. Like hey, don't equivocate the victims of Gamergate with the members of Gamergate, please. Blocked for that type shit. And I'm happy about that. Like, fuck them. I don't care now. Like, I'm with you on that one. I had those fights. I'm happy about having those fights then. But it's weird because I think now that I'm in the space, I feel like I have a now that I'm in the space as the editor-in-chief of a site, it feels like the way that I should combat that stuff is by, like, making decisions that highlight the work of marginalized writers, by making sure that you have a space and are protected to swing fists when it's time to swing fists. But me, for whatever reason, I think it's just like the role I'm supposed to play at this point. It's like I want to work on this other level where it's like, if I did that, you would suffer the consequences. I don't want the situation where Natalie doesn't get to go to a press event because I'm an asshole to somebody. But also, when someone calls up and says Rob was mean to me, Rob was mean about the division, I go to have a better answer. Right.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it's the best of both worlds. Now that I think about it. So thank you all for your various answers. Keep on moving. How's that sound? Next up is a question. It's over here. I changed all my things around. This is a similar question. Speaking of freelancing. Daniel writes in and says, I started a new creative endeavor recently. I write short opinion type articles. First, do you have any recommendations to get even a small number of views? Because I get zero. Secondly, the bigger question, how do you not drive yourself crazy worrying about them views? A lot of my creative projects seem to end once I get to the stage where I put things out there. Not being read is demoralizing, and having to hustle to be seen makes me feel needy. And not hustling to be seen makes me feel like a coward. It's not fun, and it really detracts from the joy of being creative.
I have a question. Wait, is it opiniony or oniony?
I think it's opinion.
I think it's oniony.
I think it's like the onion. Like,
I don't think it's oniony type pieces.
Okay.
I guess it could be.
I'm on Austin's side. I think it's opinion.
Team onion or team opinion?
I'm on the team opinion.
Onion. I'm like looking how you would type this. I'm not going to make fun of this.
Look,
I don't
it's
know.
A creative endeavor.
No, it's not. I'm not making fun of it at all.
I've started a blog. I'm writing opinion articles. They're doing onion articles, which is, I would say,
that
more
takes creativity.
Yeah.
They both take creativity.
Yes, they do. But I'm saying one would self-identify making assumptions.
I'm not even doing a bit or making a joke. I was actually curious if we should read it as oniony or opiniony. But it doesn't really make a difference.
It could be oniony. Anyway.
I feel like we answered a similar question to this before about, like, I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's in the same ballpark of, like, you know, how do you justify or how do you feel about doing things, like, for yourself or for, like, I think what was the term? It was professional. Like if you're not doing something that's going to be something professionalized, like, what is the point?
Right.
And this is just a different version of this, like, how do you do things that may not be viewed without obsessing about whether or not they're going to be viewed? And I don't know, like, I don't know that I do anything. There's a horror podcast that used to be a weekly thing I did with my wife called Till Death Do Us Part. And then it turned into, and we did one a year after my daughter was born.
Right.
And we did one in June. That was something I started because I just wanted, like, my wife and I often watched horror movies and then would share sort of like, did you like that movie? Yeah. Like, you know, you talk about it for a couple minutes on the ride home and then never, like, part of the enjoyment of a podcast, part of what I like about it is that it's a forced conversation in which you are, you have to start articulating your thoughts to fill space. And that often will take you down roads in which you end up, you just have to bring more to the table. You have to have a more in-depth conversation. You end up bringing more to it because it is a false conversation. You are faking a conversation and then you have to fill that space. And so I knew my wife and I both had more things we wanted to talk about, and say about these films. And so it was in an instance where, let's just force it. Let's just say we're going to do a podcast, but we got to talk for an hour. Mm-hmm. And I've had all sorts of really amazing critical conversations with my wife about movies that we like and dislike. And I have missed that we haven't done more of those for good reason. We just don't have time and we're tired. But that's an instance in where, like, yeah, I think, I don't know, like, I'm trying to think of the numbers off the top of my head. Like, when we're even doing it, like, regularly, is like, I don't know, you know, 800 people were listening a week, which is, like, just not a lot of, I mean, that to someone that doesn't have an audience, like, that probably sounds like a lot. Like, for me, that's, like, not a lot of people, because, like, that wasn't the point. Like,
right.
I mostly was just doing it because if anyone wants to listen to me and my wife do a severely underproduced podcast that is going to have an inconsistent schedule in which we're going to talk about movies that are not out right now, like, it's just, we want to have a conversation, we're recording it and just happening to share it because we thought maybe there are some people that would want to listen to it. Like, that is an instance in my life where I do something that is mostly for me, but, like, the contrivance of it being a podcast that is recorded and published forces us to, like, have a longer, more interesting conversation than just, let's talk about it over dinner, because it's just, the dinner conversation doesn't go nearly as in-depth as much as when we're asked to, like, come up with bullet points and things we want to talk about, because I just don't do that over a dinner conversation. That's much more casual. Right. It's much more surface level. So that is an instance where I have something that is mostly for me that kind of gets shared out, but I don't stress over the numbers. That said, if I could somehow transition that into writing about, if someone wants to pay me to write horror full time, I will leave this job in a heartbeat.
Damn.
That's something I'd like loyalty. To do. That's something I'd like to do in the future. Like, if somehow that laid a path to doing some, I've been writing about video games since I was 13.
Right, I get you.
if I could leave that life behind at some point, like, I could.
We launched a podcast so we could talk about things that were in video games. We did that twice. We did two of those in the last 6 weeks.
Right.
I'm there with you.
Right. So anyway, but that's a long shot. That's not going to happen. I'm going to write about video games until I'm 60 probably. It pays the bills. But that is something where it's just for me, and I don't worry too much about anyone else listening because that's just something between me and my wife.
Yeah, I will say, of course, I have a similar thing, right? Like the ridiculous Kanye West podcast that we put out once in a while with some of the Friends of the Table people is easy for me to do, and it's a fun thing for me to do, and it's a way to make sure we have those conversations about how disappointed we are about 2018. But mostly, it's easy for me to say that because I have all these other creative outlets, right? So I think one thing worth remembering about Daniel's situation is, like, Daniel, someone who wants to do creative work for a living.
Right.
We get to do creative work for a living. So I'm so sympathetic, and, like, I'm not long past that hustle. I spent years as a freelancer and as a blogger getting, you know, a couple hundred views here or there. And you know,
you're happy when someone links out to it, because 100%. Like that one link, like I remember, like that's part of the reason I started like that Worth Reading thing at Giant Bomb, was just like finding some way to link other people's.
The first time I was Worth Reading, I fucking lost my shit. Go talk to my friends. I was like, yo.
Because I remember that. Like, I think we all remember, or, you know, are in our different, you know, times removed from where one person paying attention to your work, like, meant
everything.
The world.
And so the thing I want to say there is, like, don't worry about, like, promoting your own stuff. You have to be your best. You have to be your own promoter. You have to be your own marketing team. You have to be out there sharing your stuff. Like,
and it's not egotistical to want to have people read your stuff. Like, it is not shallow to write something, share it with the world, and be like, it would feel good if people liked this, engaged with it, and responded to it. Like, that is that validation. I still crave that now, every day. It's a huge part of my drive. Like, that is not, that is nothing to feel weird about. That, like, I spent time on a thing. I would love it. It would make me feel good if there was a response to it.
Rob.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, you also have to make a point of enjoying other people's work. Because, and that doesn't just mean like going around Twitter and being like plus one to that, big ups for that oniony style article that I admire. But what it does mean is there's a couple things. First of all, like every trade, every craft is going to have cohorts. Find people who are in a similar position, like try to like find work like that, and you'll sort of lift each other up. Those people will be valued acquaintances and peers for ages, even if you end up going your separate ways in life and careers. But the other part of this is people are a lot more likely to check out your stuff if it is in some way relevant or speaks to the stuff that they care about and the stuff that they make. Like, it's a bit like the difference between a PR blast, where it's like, hey, we know that you love... insert random mobile game here, right? You know, we're offering an interview with somebody completely outside your fucking field, so you can just please promote this widget that we're releasing this Christmas, versus somebody who reaches out and they like want you specifically because your work is relevant to the stuff they're putting out there. Be that second person, and that does mean like investing the time and getting to know like the bodies of work and interests of other people.
Totally.
Yeah. I also say that, you know, to add on to the community thing, like I know like our forums have threads that are like share your work threads, or like share like looking for feedback and things like that. So there are communities out there where that is like where they are looking for that, and that is like actively encouraged. Also, writing, even if it is not being seen, is not futile, because you are in the practice of the thing that you want to do. So the fact that you are writing every day and doing the creative work is so important, just to stay in practice. So nothing is futile or pointless, totally. or you know, it is all work and it is all practice and is all like going to help you refine your voice and make you a better writer. So
related, people should come read Natalie's first article on the site.
Oh,
in the last little bit. Hot Pot Panic is a charming fake friendship simulator. People may remember that we used to have a section called Free Play, a column called Free Play, that's about free games, independent and alternative games, and anything that's free. So demos, all sorts of stuff. They're just kind of a short write-up about bringing your attention to something you might not know you can go play for free right now. And Natalie is bringing that section back with a new, maybe once or twice a week. It looks like twice a week is what we're going for. And the first one is up there now. So go read that on the site. Congrats to Natalie. Promote your shit,
guys.
some tips I'll say on promoting stuff in 2018. I cannot oversell the like screenshot a thing you wrote, a good line from a thing you wrote technique. Yeah. Selling something based on the headline and an image is like never as effective as selling something that kind of summarizes and says in your most either most funny, most clever, most powerful phrasing.
But
the
in
point
your
that you're
voice,
trying to make
yeah.
in your voice, yeah. Especially as you continue to build. And that was like, that's been the strategy for me for whatever, 4 years now. Don't feel bad about resharing something. Twitter moves so quickly that, you know, I think in our experience of using Twitter, we often see tweets multiple times, but the majority of people who use Twitter do not see tweets very long. There's like a short window of time in which you can see it. And also, it's super easy to ignore someone who's like, hey, I'm sharing this thing again. Like, good. Like, let them share it again. That's not a big deal. So make sure you're out there. Promote your stuff. If you're proud of it, you know, if you're working on it, you should be proud of it. And if you're proud of it, like, share it, right? Like, that's one of the hardest things to do, but get it out there. There are limits, obviously. Like, I've definitely had people respond to conversations that they're not in that aren't about the thing they're about, that are like, hey, can you read this article for me and give me feedback? Which is like, we've never spoken before. I'm talking about the Philadelphia Eagles, and you're asking me to read this essay
about... Yeah, read the room.
and I think that can be frustrating, because there is such like a mythology of the go-getter who gets out there and like puts their work in front of people, and there it goes. And I think that speaks back to Rob's thing, which is like, find those conversations and those cohorts that are actually the people who are at the place that you're at, trying to, you know, build their own portfolios, have conversations with them about their work, have kind of a productive, and that's any field, that whether that is like, whether these are opiniony articles or oniony articles, people are out there doing other opiniony stuff and other oniony stuff. People are doing satire. People are doing,
when you never
covers.
You never know which one of those people is going to be the one that gets plucked out, right? Yep. So it's like,
I would not be here without Cameron Kunzelman. I've said this before, but like, Cameron and I were both in the same cohort of like Blogger. Cameron had a setup at Paste, and Cameron brought me into Paste to write about, I don't even remember what our first article was, but we co-wrote an article together. And I think it was about an indie game like conference, like a live stream conference. And we wrote about that together. And at that point, Garrett over at Paste is the one who was like, yeah, keep writing for me. And from there, like, that was the thing that happened. But I'd already written for, you know, a long time, either on tiny baby sites that I was helping to run the way a lot of people do in their teens and early 20s, or just as a blogger on my own site. And like, that's exactly it. You never know who is the one who is going to help you build that bridge forward. So,
because then you can help bring those people with you.
And, totally.
You know, that's a huge part of what we try to do at Waypoint, is like trying to figure out those two. Oh, who can we pay that wasn't getting paid elsewhere?
There's too many people.
Once you're in the ecosystem, it's not a guarantee, but you sure as hell got a better chance once you have something you can point to.
Totally. Once you have that portfolio that says like, oh yeah, I've been published at blank. Like for me, going from Paste to getting a couple of reviews at GameSpot meant the world, right? Not that Paste is not a publication of note. I love Paste. Again, I would not be here without Paste. But for a certain type of reader and a certain type of editor, showing up on GameSpot meant something in a really big way. And all I hope for is that Waypoint has been that for a couple of people, has been like, okay, hey, yeah, this is from... I'll say this is like one of the biggest things when I was at Giant Bomb setting up our freelance program there. And Patrick, I bet you ran into this, because I know that effort started with you before I was even there. But like, yep. There were nothing but brick walls with trying to get that thing going, because CBS was not as a company built to do that, right? CBS
entering that payment system was one of the most surreal experiences of my professional career. Like
they were not meant. It was not built to bring in anyone but employees, uh-huh. And you managed to finish the project that I began, and you did most of the work on that. Let me be exceptionally clear. But yeah, like there are institutions that are sometimes not built to even like bring in outsiders. Like,
well, and one of the hardest. Go ahead, Rob. As someone who wrote for that system
I didn't write much for it, mainly because I did the math and I was like, invoicing through this may not actually be profitable. like the moment I knew like we were not in Kansas anymore is you had to go through their contractor system, and they've got a one size fits all contractor system, and they start out by asking you a question: are you going to be invoicing for $250,000 or more or less than that? And that was like the two ticky like boxes. It was like, so are you like a $250,000 or higher vendor, or like are you small? And I'm like, much smaller. Like,
but like, and then those questions were like, oh, so are you going to be, if you're going to be on site, are you going to be protected? Are you going to have like safety gear? What? How much equipment do you need to borrow for this assignment? What?
The comment section can be bad, but it's not that bad.
Do you carry legal liability insurance? It's amazing.
Because it's CBS, because they're like getting contractors to like go on set or to go on, yeah. You know, to go across the world to build something for something. You know what I mean? And the biggest thing ended up being, and we solved this, but when I started that program, when I started trying to build it, they were like, well, we cannot work with someone who does not have prior publication. We cannot do it. Like, it's too risky to work with someone who does not have a proof of employment in the field, which when you're talking about $250,000 or more, when you're talking about construction or production or whatever, I get that. But we're like, yo, I'm just trying to pay someone a couple hundred bucks to like write 1,000 words about the division. Please let me do this. And that sort of stuff, we solved it. I want to be clear. Like, it was solved. I ended up working with some people who at the time, who've gone on to do great things. Like, it is a great point of personal pride that I got to work with Gita Jackson and with Heather Alexander, who would go on to do great work at Kotaku. Rob, you and I worked together there. And like, I worked with a bunch of incredible people through that program. But that problem is not unique, or was not unique to CBS Interactive. Plenty of places have that sort of situation where it is hard if you do not have a portfolio to move into that space. Getting that, building those relationships so that you get the person who's going to fight for you to get you into that space means so much. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll answer a few more questions before wrapping up.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, what is everyone good at? That's the question that Basil wants to know. They write in and they say, this isn't necessarily a question about video games, though I suspect for many, if not most of you, it will be. I was recently asked, what are the three games of any kind that you are best at? And I found myself stumped. It became an interesting exercise in thinking positively about myself, but was surprisingly difficult to even come up with candidates. I eventually settled on crossword puzzles. Are these even a game? Yes, those are games. Contract Bridge. And Scrabble.
Wow, Bridge is fucking hard. Can I just say, like, Bridge is so complicated and hard.
Yeah, Bridge is amazing. Bridge is wild. There are some good Idle Thumbs episodes about Bridge, in which I caused me to go on a spree of learning about Bridge, and it seems rough.
Oh, the partner rules.
Yeah,
that's Jake. Those are very good episodes of Idle Thumbs.
Yeah, Natalie, do you have a Bridge partner?
Oh, God, no. I had to learn about Bridge for at NYU. The intro class for the game center is Games 101.
Right.
And I had to learn the rules of Bridge for the class. And it was so complicated and, like, impossible to learn when we're doing, like, the card games unit. But we had to play a round of Bridge, I remember, in, like, the seminar or the... what is it called? Recitation. Mm-hmm. for that lecture, and it was funny.
But people should look at Bridge rules. They are wild.
They are wild.
Basil says, I'd like to ask the same question of y'all, but maybe more generally, what are the kinds of games you're best at? Do you like them better for that reason, or despite it, or do you not even like them better? Best, Basil.
I love this question.
That's a great question. What are the games you're good at, Natalie? Yeah, if you like the question so much, what's your answer?
Step up. Be good at answering this question.
Well, obviously, as you can see from the 36 hour that we did, I'm exceptionally good at Dance Dance Revolution.
Oh,
No, that is a full lie. I'm really bad at it, I discovered. Much to my memory's dismay, because I had painted myself as like an acclaimed Dance Dance Revolution.
Award-winning.
Award-winning, and I'm not. I'm absolutely not. I would say the games that the first game to that came to my mind of that I'm best at are P-Cross games. I love and I'm pretty good at those. I'm currently playing P-Cross 2, which just came out on Switch, so I'm playing that, and I love those games. I'm also really good at Solitaire. I love playing Solitaire, and it, like, I don't know why, but I can spend hours and hours and hours in a Solitaire, just, like, over and over and over again, doing multiple Solitaire rounds. And they just released a Solitaire game for Switch that is not Spider Solitaire. It's Klondike Solitaire, which is the version I like best. Mm. So I'm very excited about that.
Damn. That's a very... I wish... Man, I should get into some different types of Solitaire. I never really learned anything else.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
I don't know why. And then I'm trying to think of a third one. So maybe somebody else should go while I think of my third one.
Would you look for you? Go ahead.
For me, it's like the larger umbrella of it are sort of like it is sort of platformers, but it's like Mega Man 2 is one of my favorite games of all time, and
like action platformers.
Yeah, like which then encompasses things like Spelunky, Binding of Isaac. I think it also brings in like Dark Souls. Mm. Like there are a lot of like splinters out from there. But things that are like very Twitch action based, in which like a lot of what you're doing is very in the moment decision making that involves your fingers, as opposed to like part of the reason I don't like strategy games is I just tend to struggle with like thinking ahead an hour of what I'm supposed to be doing and working towards that goal. Like I work better in games that demand immediacy, and so I think that helps explain like both my preference and enjoyment and skill at like those types of games. I mean, it's a reason that like when I started playing Dead Cells that like I was rolling over a lot of it, was because like I just have a lot of institutional knowledge in which other types of games that are playing other types of things I just immediately apply to this game, and that I'm not having to get over certain humps. So like those are like, there aren't many game genres that I like find myself saying like, oh, I'm good at, like I'm confident I want to jump into this and be pretty good. Like, that's why I kind of felt that way about Dead Cells. People were like, this game's hard. It's like, I'm sure it's hard, but like, I actually feel good about going into it and being like, I don't think it's going to be that hard for me. It's like the one genre in which I can like reasonably say, like, I know I'm going to be good at this, because for whatever reason, it just sort of clicks into place. It actually like fits into like a larger model of my life, in which like I'm much better at things that are in front of me in like small to medium projects than like longer big term thing, like big things. Like, it's why I've like struggled to ever conceive of like writing a book, because I just don't know that I would have the mental capacity. Like, I'm like, oh, if I could write a book, could each chapter be could it be like an anthology, or like each chapter is building to a larger point? The idea of like coming up with a narrative that would like fill, you know, 200 pages, like I just don't know that I could do that. And like, it's weird how that maps to my own like playing habits.
Rob, you seem deep in thought. Oh, sorry, Patrick, did you basically give us, like, one, but really broad? You didn't give us three? Okay.
I don't think I have three. Like, I think it's, like, I don't know that there are other games that I'm probably, like, if I'm being, like, hyper-specific and, like, a game that, like, I'm good at, it's, like, it's that. And, and it spoke.
That's fair.
Because I could tell you, like, oh, Spelunky, oh, Dead Cells. But, like, it's really, like, if you're to dig into, like, what it is, like, a specific type of kind of platformer action game, and then a bunch of games splinter out of that.
Yeah. Mm. I have like two categories for sure, and they're opposites in some ways. And also, one of them I think I'm genuinely good at, and that is like tabletop RPGs of like the story game variety. I run a lot of those. It's a thing I do. It's a game. Those are games, and I do well at it. And I'm proud of that. And I've worked hard at getting good at telling stories with my friends by way of playing like tabletop role-playing games.
I just want to point out there's a distinct amount of Robin doesn't seem fully convinced by Austin's argument. It's not coming across in the pie.
I thought about it. I was skeptical. I was being elitist. And then I thought about it again. Like, there's a skill to, like, because it's a bit like improv, especially if you're a game master. Not like a game master, but like your GM in an RPG system. There is a skill. Like being a useful collaborator in an RPG is a skill that is valuable.
I know that because I've had bad GMs, and I do my best not to be like them with my players. And I think that I'm genuinely good at that in a way that I think I can be confident in. The other thing I'm less confident in, except in this very broad sense, which is like I think games, there's kind of maybe two subcategories here. One is kind of tactical games, tactics games, especially the super hyper like subgenre of like tactical roguelikes. Of like the Invisible Ink and Into the Breach variety, but then also the other thing there. So tactics games in general, especially those, but then also like card games like Hearthstone or Netrunner or Legend of the Five Rings or Magic. But I'm not actually good at any of those. I'm just better than the people who play them less than even me, right? So like I'm not good at Slay the Spire, but I'm better than other amateurs at Slay the Spire.
For your class.
Yeah.
For your
level. Like I'm not going to put in however many hours I have in Slay the Spire or even in Invisible, maybe in Invisible Ink I actually got to be pretty good at because I put enough time into it to where I really was in a higher class of a higher class of play. Fuck off, Austin. you know what I'm saying, right? Like I put in enough to where you would just say by hour count, you should group me in a different class of players in different like weight class, so to speak. But for something like Slay the Spire or Hearthstone, where I have not put in a lot of time, Slay the Spire, I have like a minuscule amount of time in, right? I have like 30 hours in it. It sounds like a lot, but compared to like, I was on a Three Moves Ahead about it with people who had like 300 hours, they'd beat the shit out of me if that game had a competitive mode. They would kick my whole face in. But to other people who've put in the amount of time I've put in, I think I would do much better because I have like a really good understanding of these rule sets in general and games like this in general, the structure of a deck builder, the structure in a roguelike of figuring out your character build early and not trying to like do everything and making sure that you're willing to specialize and throw out stuff you don't need. In a game like Invisible Ink or Into the Breach, I'm pretty good at anticipating future moves and making sure that I don't make moves that shut off my own ability to make to change and go in a different direction in the future. I'm also super rusty with Invisible Ink, so every time I jump back into it, I'm like, fuck, this game is hard. But that's probably, those are the ones that I'm like, I think I'm genuinely good as a GM and as like tabletop story games, and then I'm like better than my weight class in tactics, and especially in like tactical roguelike stuff. But if you've seen me stream XCOM, you know that I'm also like quick to make bad choices, quick to make some misclicks, the stuff that still marks me as an amateur.
But some of that's fueled by your own confidence that can do it, right? Like the reason you're making those amateur hour mistakes is because you have a certain confidence in yourself that is fueled by like past accomplishments.
100%. I mean, Rob, you can speak to this for sure. Like we're at the point of the XCOM 2 thing now where it's like there isn't a hole we can dig that we can't climb out of, partially because of that game's like power curve. We've just gotten so strong, but also partially because like we've pulled ourselves back from the brink on some missions where we have royally fucked up through some like pretty clever maneuvering. Yeah. And it's fun. That's part of the fun of that game for me.
Yeah, that's definitely a case of we sort of learned on the job, and at a certain point, like, I don't know that we're great XCOM players. We're really great with these sorts of characters we build. And at this point, we've got sort of our tool bag, and XCOM at a certain point will just let you, like, use those tools again and again until all the Chosen are dead. I think, what am I good at? Hard question. Not much.
It's hard.
No, hold on. I think there's another issue here, which is that it's sort of what Austin was referring to, the Slay the Spire. You start playing a game like that, and it's very easy to quickly realize, like, I'm not good at this at all. Because chances are the people you're going to meet who are playing that, who are active players, play a lot of it, and they're going to stomp you. They've got a lot of experience. So you're going to discover that the people who have self-selected to remain in the community tend to be pretty good. Like the game clicks with them. They've invested the time. They've gotten good at it. So are you good at it? Well, you're better. You're smarter than the average bear, but you're not going to be playing the average bear in a competitive environment, not for long. And so I think there's this this has come up around the RTS space a little bit. In the 90s, real-time strategy games all had single-player campaigns. They were a very popular genre. And part of it is because it was easy to make an RTS game that looked a lot better than a lot of other games that were out there at the time. But the other thing was, most people weren't playing against other people. And so you could play an RTS game and be like, damn, I'm good at this game. And one of the things that...
I made a lot of mammoth tanks, and I sent that to the other base, and I destroyed it. That's me.
Yeah, or maybe you had, like, a regular land group you played with, and, like, you were good in that setting, and so that was fun, and you're like, damn, like, I'm really good at, like, Brood War. And then you log on, like, you get an internet connection that's decent, you start playing, and you realize, like, I'm fucking trash at this game. And so I kind of look at this as, I'm not very good at most of the games I play. Like, I am going to be better at most racing games than somebody who just picks it up, but like among serious racing game fans, middling at best, probably not even that competitive. You know, war games, I tend to be like, I play a bunch of them, but I tend to not get great at hardly any of them, and so I tend to play like overly cautious conservative games. I'm still trying to figure out the rules. So I mean, the things that I sort of look at as my strong suit is like, you know, racing games, because not a lot of people take them seriously. I kind of do, but I'm going to be middling at best there. A particular type of war game, like anything that's really about like a lot of like less about reflexes and more about laying the groundwork and like lots of planning and like setting the stage beforehand. Like that's my kind of shit.
You're good at subterfuge.
I'm again.
You made some good plays. You made some good plays.
I was playing differently in this game. I think I kind of clicked with what you have to do in subterfuge, and then it was a different sort of game. And then tactical shooters, but not like milsim shooters, but not action shooters. Like my sweet spot is anything from like Battlefield Speed through like Fear, first encounter assault recon.
Right. Sure. I mean,
thank you for spelling it, just in case people didn't know.
Yeah, totally.
I didn't, so thank you, Rob.
Have to educate the youths.
Oh, man. Is Fear available in any sort of, like,
I mean, I think it's on Steam
mode?
No, it's
no, but any sort of, they ever, it's just on Steam.
Timeless.
Apparently. I just thought of one more thing. We're in this pat ourselves on the back segment. It's actually a thing I wish I could do more of, because this is not I'm good at it. It's I think I'd be good at it if I got to do it more, which is I've done a couple of like Destiny raids. I've done some like, you know, I've played some MMOs and done a couple of raids in that scenario. And I don't have the time in my life to like play those games in a serious sense. But when I've done raids, especially when I've done raids on like a day one, no one knows what the fuck they're doing. We're all trying to learn this mechanic together. I do a really good job of just like keeping people happy and like focused and breaking down raid, like going through the Kallus raid, which is the first Destiny 2 raid on like the night it launched, and figuring out baths and figuring out the dogs and like the some of the various mini game structures, being able to identify those games, which is actually, now that I think about it, it's like the same, that's the same thing that I do well in a card game or in a tactics game. It's like, oh, I see the moving pieces. I see where the interaction points are. Do you know that thing in old cartoons where you can tell the difference between, you can tell what's going to be animated because the backdrops are painted in a certain way and then the cells of the animation stand out? That's what video games look like to me most of the time. Where I'm like, okay, these are the parts that matter. These are the things that interact. When I do this, this other thing happens. And that will not make me a good player at the high level, but it will make me a very intuitive player who can understand the types of questions that the game designers are asking me to solve. I might not be able to execute on that solution. I might have to be like, hey, Rob, can you get this? Can you be on headshot duty for the next like 5 minutes? Because we have to get 17 headshots to open the door or whatever. So I'm not good at delegation either, is what we're finding out. I should have picked Natalie, who's the headshot queen. But you know,
I am the headshot queen.
So Natalie,
actually,
I need you on headshot.
The joyous
duty.
Gamer is a stone cold killer.
Totally, but like things like that, like things like, okay, I was doing that raid on that day one, and it was like, okay, I'm going to delegate who is in charge of what based on what I've seen them doing and based on how asleep they are because it's 3 a.m. And that was actually really fun and really worked out. And I wish I had the time in my life to like do that stuff. Because I think I have the right attitude to like be a coach, but not be like be firm and make the right calls, but not be an asshole about it. And I've dealt with some real assholes in those situations, and that's the fucking worst. So, all right. What do you think? One more?
Sure.
Yeah, let's do one more.
Let's do one more. This one comes in from Adam, who says, I hope everyone, I'm going to say this came in before BlizzCon, it's worth noting. Adam says, hope everyone is doing well. On a somewhat recent Waypoint Radio, Natalie and Danielle mentioned how they felt disappointed by the way Mario Party and Paper Mario have evolved over the years. On another episode, Austin discussed Fallout 76 and the changes to the franchise. Cameron Kunzelman also wrote on the power fantasies in that game, and I was reminded that Bethesda proudly boasted that you'd be able to launch nuclear missiles at other players. That's a pretty massive departure from the anti-nuclear themes of past games. Do you have any series near and dear to your heart in gaming or otherwise that you felt like made major turns for the worse as they went on? Also, do you ever fall into that consumerist trap of feeling quote unquote betrayed by a corporation's handling of their IP that you are owed something? Thanks, and don't let anybody scuff your shine. P.S. I felt betrayed by Metroid Federation Force and Other M, but my fury has been quelled. I bring this up because we didn't talk about it on Monday. I don't want to I kind of don't want to go in on this because I.
Well, it's also probably overstated.
I've been frustrated by a range of coverage. It is. That's exactly it. That's exactly to some degree. But there was an incredibly negative and hateful response to Blizzard announcing Diablo Immortal, a mobile version of Diablo that's being made by NetEase or with NetEase, which is a company that has made some Diablo-inspired games on mobile, I'd say. And the response was, to say it was furious is probably putting it lightly, from those who were very loud about it. We don't have numbers on how many people that is, right? Like, I know that it was all over Reddit for a couple of days afterwards. And there was this very frustrating thing where what began as just kind of raw consumer revolt quickly dressed itself up as being high-minded criticism. You know, it was like, fuck you. And is this a joke that you would announce this at this thing? And I'm not saying that Blizzard... I am surprised Blizzard made this announcement. I think it was...
They fucked up. Like,
I think it was a
wild
naive
miscalculation
absolutely
for a fan event to end on that note.
But the response was of a sort that was so enraged, like, during an election week. Like, it was just one of those, like, perfect storms of me rolling my eyes. Of like, there is so much in the world to be fucking enraged with. Look at the news on any day. To bring that level of anger to bear on this felt like a lot. But the heart of it was this feeling of like, hey, this isn't what we want. And then eventually that turned into like, and also remember, mobile games, they're exploitative. And it's like, well, that's not what people were mad about to begin with. Don't dress that shit up. What people were mad about to begin with was this feeling that this isn't there.
That it wasn't Diablo 4.
It wasn't Diablo 4. Exactly.
That's what, yeah.
And that's made me think, like, is there something like that for me? I'm still struggling. I don't know if there is. Natalie.
I don't think
Harry
so.
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
That has to do more with J.K. Rowling than it has to do with Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I saw a J.K. Rowling bot the other day that was like, the Weasley's car is lesbian. And that just cracked me the fuck up.
Oh, damn. We're watching Utena in here? Shit.
Oh, my God.
Anyway. There's not. I mean,
let's say in the softer sense. Because, like, remember, the question isn't like, have
it doesn't
you ever
have to be
been
like
an
you
asshole?
Wanted to go to Reddit and like rage about a game, but like being like profoundly disappointed in a sequel or ultimate direction of a franchise.
The definitely the direction that the Paper Mario games took was like super disappointing to me, because the most valuable part of the formula that they had was the battle mechanic and ally system. Like, that was the most enjoyable thing for me, and that's what I loved, and then that was completely gone. But that was that, and I just didn't play the rest of the games. I don't have like such a loyalty to any franchise that I like. Oh, actually, I did try Sticker Star, and that's why I figured out that it was bad, but or that it just wasn't my taste. But I don't have such a loyalty to a thing that like. My disappointments are different. My disappointment, like, I was, like, a Harry Potter stan. My disappointment is in J.K. Rowling in being fucking the worst. And my disappointment is in them casting Johnny Depp for right. Grindelwald when he yes. and like not going back on that. Like those kinds of things are where my disappointment lies, not in like the IP, or I guess it is in the IP itself too, but it's more the way that like the creators like oh yeah, Hermione could be black, like we never said it, like that kind of stuff just like feels like such a like a cop out, and like there isn't a lot of accountability there, and it is trying to like it feels very pandering to me, and that's what feels bad. But in terms of games, I don't think I feel entitled to such a thing that I would be super like I could never imagine myself like revolting. And I couldn't see oh now the question's gone.
Oh sorry. I'll bring it back.
It's okay.
There you go.
You've
never been betrayed, quote unquote. You never felt betrayed or that you're owed something.
Yeah, no, I don't, because they're creators, and I and creators do what they will with the things that they create. Like it is cool that we have conversations, that there are conversations that are had between audiences, and games are such a particular thing, because I think we were saying this in one of the past podcasts, but that they are such larger time investments than other cultural products, like movies or TV shows or whatever. Like the amount of time that goes into a typical AAA game at this point is 50 to 60 hours plus, which is a significant portion of one's life. And so I do understand why having like feeling that disappointment is like it does feel like a betrayal, because you were already going to invest the time, and if that time isn't going to be invested in something that you love, in a series that you have loved, I understand, but I could never like take it to
I came up with I remember so I've always said that a few my two favorite games of all time that like are rooted in like two different types of games that I've grown to enjoy are Mega Man 2 and Deus Ex. And I remember even at the age that I was being not just disappointed, but angry at how bad Deus Ex Invisible War was, a game that like so profoundly misread the things that were interesting about Deus Ex. And it was technically incompetent. The story was all over the place. It was like, I remember being like, At that, like, when did that game come out? Deus Ex War. That is 2003. Like, that was one of the first times where, like, I played a sequel and, like, felt insulted by it. And that a game had just, like, so profoundly misread what was interesting that at that time I was already starting to write about games as, like, a deep amateur. But I remember that game feeling like a sense of betrayal because it was just so incredibly bad.
Yeah. It's funny. It's like I came to that series late, and definitely because I knew what 2 would be, I was able to be like, oh, yeah, right. And that one's bad. That's okay. Yeah. It's ironic because the easiest ones for me to think up are things that were actually big disappointments over the direction of a game that went into mobile. Things like Galaxy Variant S or whatever the mobile variant is.
Right.
But the Switch version of it. Fantasy Life didn't get a real sequel. It got a sequel on like the phones, and Fantasy Life was like my favorite game in 2014.
I love Fantasy Life.
It's so good. And that got a sequel for phones.
I didn't even know that.
It got a sequel. Not in the West. Only in, Japan. Things like that. But I never got mad about it. I just got like, oh man, it'd be cool if we could get those. There's a lot of that. And there are times when things have definitely taken a turn where I'm like, oh, this isn't for me anymore. A big one for that is like, and this is weird, I like this game, right? But not as much as I like previous entries, is Skyrim. I was an Elder Scrolls fan, not since the beginning by any means, but playing Morrowind on my Xbox and then on my PC, I was like, wow, I love this. I love it so much. And like Oblivion blew me away on Xbox 360, even though it started to take some turns in terms of like you know, it was not as original of a setting. Morrowind, the Isle of Vordenfell, is this like super unique world where there's this like volcano, and there's all these different tribes of people, and there's this imperial occupation that's happening, but it's kind of been fought off, and so there's only a couple of cities where the imperials are, and there are these weird mushroom wizard houses.
I never played like Daggerfall, skipped Morrowind, and then got in, and then didn't play Oblivion, but I remember of like the series was weirder.
Yes, if I could aesthetically, anyway. If I could snap my fingers, would it be worth it?
And just have feet.
It's like Gift of the Magi, where I get rid of my fingers to turn them into, exactly. If I could scrap my fingers, turn them into materials, and then like alchemy them together into a potion, I must be playing Morrowind, because that is the most Morrowind shit. Morrowind felt so good. Like, the world was so unique, and I have so many fond memories of, like, being introduced to first person. I like played a couple of other first person Western RPGs, but like nothing consumed me the way that had. Previously, I'd only really played kind of like the Baldur's Gate series and maybe like a couple of the Gold Box D&D things. Like nothing like that consumed me the way playing Morrowind for the first time did, and brought me into its world and made me so inquisitive about everything. Oblivion was like a step forward in so many ways in terms of presentation, but a step back in terms of the unique qualities of the world, because it's basically just like Western fantasy with a few unique twists, but largely it was just like, oh, okay, there's like, you know, castles and a vampire and eventually a dragon, you know? And so Skyrim continued in that direction. And I was like, okay. There's like not stats in the way, there's not like a attributes in the way that there used to be, like strength and things like that. There's just these skill trees. And there's not the same kind of mix of all of these different factions. There's kind of just like these three or four. And, you know, this thing didn't really work for me. I liked Skyrim a bunch still. I still played, again, you know, if you check Steam, I probably well over 100 hours just on Steam, not counting my original playthrough, you know, not counting my whatever my Xbox 360 playthrough was. But there was something about it that made me go like, okay, they're taking this from me. And the follow-up is like, and that's okay, right? Like I'm happy to live in the world in which I only play 80 hours of Skyrim, you know, but that people who would have ignored this series forever because it was as janky as Morrowind is are now getting to have this version of it. I'm fine with that. There's other stuff there's so many things for me to go do. There's so many things that I'm like that I installed on my computer this week, books that I have or books on my Kindle, TV shows that I haven't gotten around to, albums I haven't listened to, like so many things I haven't revisited, you know. I have it in my heart that one of these days I'm going to do a full replay of Far Cry 2, like I haven't made time for that because I keep playing new stuff. So like I'm okay with those things kind of becoming a little more general and slipping away from the thing that I once loved, which is like something like Fallout 76. Like, I'm good. Like, it might not be for me. I'm going to still try it when it really releases. I'll still put some time into it and curious about it. But it's okay that it's not for me. Like, there's a bunch of other stuff that is. And I want to save the vigor of kind of going hard at companies for when I think they are – when I know they are either being exploitative of their workers and their, you know, labor abuses, when I know that they have a scheme in place to exploit the whims and the kind of the lizard brains of players and get them to go hard into what is effectively gambling or gambling adjacent behaviors. Those are where I want to hit them. When I know that they are being transphobic or racist or sexist, like both in terms of content and in terms of workplace, like that is what I save that anger for, because it is in limited supply. Like I cannot be, though, and it should be, like, I can't be angry for this thing is more streamlined and casual with the same vitriol, with the same like energy that I can be for, and this company has mandatory overtime. Like, those two things aren't comparable for me. One of those is so much more important. And that means that I'm not the ideal critic for a lot of people. And I think that's fine. Like, in the same way, that's okay.
What if Andromeda was better?
Yeah, totally. What if Andromeda was better? That'd be cool. But you know, what's the thing that Don Draper tells Peggy? You won't believe how much this never happened. I'll go my whole life without thinking about Andromeda again. There's so much other fucking shit in my life. It's just
gone.
That is
a too
trivial
deployment of it will shock you how much this never happened. That's not for fucking Andromeda, man.
It will shock you
how
much Mass Effect Andromeda never happened. Because there's so much else for me to get, to get heated up about in the world. It sucked. I played that game. I wrote about it. I'm not saying I didn't engage with how much it disappointed me. You can go read that piece. It's called Mass Effect Andromeda Didn't Give Me a World Worth Saving. I was very upset about it, in terms of I'm disappointed. But now I'm good. I put that take out into the world.
I'm still bummed.
Yeah, they'll do more with it. There's other stuff. I got three games I really liked out of that franchise. Sure. I got 100 hours or whatever, maybe more, because I played through Mass Effect 1 3 times, you know?
What's happiness, Austin, is that feeling you get before you want more of it. Three games? You're not satisfied with three games. You're not satisfied until you have 100.
Nostalgia is a Greek word. That means, all right, I think that's going to do it for us before we...
Has Rob ever been angry?
No.
Yeah, Rob, have you ever been an angry gamer?
Because when this question came up, your initial reaction was to go, yeah, it seemed like you had something.
I missed that facial expression.
No. That was a different...
No, what is it? Man.
No. All right. Some quick hits.
Got a list.
I'm sorry. The Heir to the Empire trilogy was canon, okay? It was canon, and it was a good continuation of Star Wars that was, better than... No, it fucking doesn't. It didn't happen. It's basically fan fiction at this point. It's trash, okay?
Fan fiction's good.
Out the window. Yes, but it's not real, and it was real, and now it's not. Just like TIE Fighter.
Wow.
So they destroyed that, and I'm very angry. Total War... They used to have a risk style map, and holy shit, the strategy campaign actually worked when they had the risk style map. But the masses, the commoners, were like, oh no, we must have a 3D map, because 3D is inherently better, because we're gamers, and technological advancements are mesmerizing to us, fucking shiny keys. So, the Total War game still, it's a 50-50 shot whether or not the campaign layer works at all, whether it's even, borderline competent. But nobody fucking notices because nobody remembers Medieval. I remember Medieval, but everyone looks at me like, Rob, let it go. Jesus Christ, they've got so many games. Find one that you like. And it's no, they all have to be from me. And, Jesus Christ, I'm sorry. Ron and Hermione shouldn't have gotten together. Ron is bad news. Okay? You're going to doom an important female character, an empowering female character, to a life of dealing with a guy who spends six fucking books tearing his friends down until they make him feel special. Holy shit, what a nightmare outcome for that character. We all know how it should have gone. We all read the fan fictions. Hermione should have been with Harry. It's even sort of hinted at in halfway through that seventh book. But no. Detour straight back to Ron because, hey, absolutely, get back with the mediocrity who's nagged you for 8 years.
Wow. Rob, you're starting to sound like the person who made the tweet that made me go to sleep for the first time. Can I read you this take? I've been finally telling people about it because I looked it up, and the tweet in question has since been deleted, or the series of tweets in question are no longer on Twitter, which means this person isn't name searchable. The inspiration for "Have you ever read a take so bad it makes you immediately go to sleep?" Can I read you this take?
Yeah.
Yes. Please.
My fear is that The Last of Us 2 is getting made not because the principals of Naughty Dog need more money, but that they're doing it for the staff. Their thought is, this will make enough money to really take care of everyone who works here for years and years to come. They continue, we should burn down our greatest achievement, The Last of Us 1, to help Julie in accounts receivable put her kids through college. Well, I disagree. Art suffered enough in this century. Julie and her kids have barely suffered at all. It's disproportionate. Real take on someone who is disappointed that there would be a sequel to a thing.
That is cruel and unenlightened. That is about that is about punching down. I don't punch down.
I see.
I'm
not
just,
like
no,
you.
No, I'm just speaking truth on behalf of
to power.
Yeah, on behalf of gamers. I'm just being consumerist. Like, these companies like think they're entitled to like massive profit margins based on like popular games, and they totally abandon the people who got them there. I'm thinking about the little people.
I want to
just
break
gamer things.
Just gamer
am I
things.
Right?
Find Rob Zachney's new column over at The Escapist. Starting,
going home, baby.
Oh, I broke my rule. I was like, I'm not going to throw any punches, and then yikes!
You punched.
All right. On that note, I think we're going to wrap up today. Thank you all for joining us, Natalie. Where can people find you on Twitter?
At Natalie Watson.
How about you, Rob?
At Rob Zachney.
And Patrick.
At Patrick Kulpik.
Find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Find Cotto at @A_Cotto_appears. Find everything we do at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, and waypoint.vice.com. As always, if you could go give us a review over on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or whatever it is you listen to us on, Google Play, please do that.
Spotify.
We're on Spotify now. Go shout us out and give us a thumbs up or a 5-star or a review of some kind. It means a lot because that is the way that we get the word out there. As always, thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. And as always, if you have questions that you want added to the old question bucket.
What the fuck?
What the fuck's a box? All I know about is buckets. Gaming at Vice.
That's all I be making. Buckets.
All I make is buckets. I make them buckets. Gaming@vice.com is the address. Use the subject line question and we will be sure to see it. Does anyone want to take us out with some words of wisdom on a day like today?
Every time Ed is in an episode, she completely destroys the tonal consistency of Cowboy Bebop. Like, I just don't understand how people are like, Ed's the best. One of the great characters of the series. Do you not see how good the Spike and Vicious episodes are? They're amazing. Why couldn't it just be about, like, samurai mobsters? That sounds fucking awesome, right? That would have been cool. But no.
Peace. Bye. Bye. Bye.
On a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.